name is Peter Keisler, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to welcome all of you here to tonight's banquet. This weekend, we're going to try to do what the Federalist Society always does, which is to bring together prominent members of the bar, of academia, and of the bench to address important issues and to make remarks that can be used against them at subsequent confirmation hearings. In that regard, we'd like to extend a special welcome to Frank Easterbrook and Edith Jones. We're delighted to have you here, and we hope you'll make full use of this opportunity. To introduce tonight's speaker, I'd like to present David McIntosh. David is one of the original founders of this organization, both the founder of the University of Chicago chapter and of the National Federalist Society. He's been a member of the board since its beginning. He's national co-chairman, and he currently serves as the assistant to the vice president for domestic policy. David.
Thank you very much, Peter. Our guest speaker tonight has told me that he needs to be in a bed and fairly early, so I'm going to shorten my introduction in the interest of letting you hear somebody who actually has something to say. Our guest tonight is a man who over the years has contributed a great deal to the Federalist Society, as well as to the ideals for which the Society stands. Like the Federalist Society, he has always championed the view that ideas are what matter in public life, and lively debate about those ideas are the best signs of a healthy democracy. In Washington, this attitude, that intellectual controversy has to be sought after rather than shunned, was tantamount to heresy. But it was hardly a surprising one, coming from a man who played in a rock and roll band called Plato and the Guardians, or in another band called Graham and the Crackers. But he is not only a musician, he's a trained professor of philosophy, taught at the Boston University, University of Mississippi, and the National Humanities Center in North Carolina. We're all familiar with his record here in Washington as chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Secretary of Education, and in the Bush administration as director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. It's fitting that he should be our guest tonight, because few people in American public life have so strongly defended the idea of individual responsibility and have so strongly rejected the notion that the victim is not the victim mentality that underpins many of our present social programs. Our guest may have made one or two enemies in the process of that argument. One recent magazine article noted that his critics have at various times called him sexist, racist, elitist, imperialist, bourgeois, a Neanderthal, a loose cannon, a motor mouth, Mr. Aggressive Steamroller, and my personal favorite, the Morton Downey of the Department of Education. We at the Federalist Society, however, are proud to call Secretary Bennett a close friend. He was a speaker at one of our early meetings here in Washington, in fact, one of our best meetings. And although he may not remember, those of us who were founders of the Society have fond memories of one of the early meetings with Secretary Bennett and Bill Kristol and other leading intellectuals in the conservative movement. We were just getting the Federalist Society started at that time and asked their advice for where we should go and what we should do. It's been implementing that advice that has brought the Federalist Society to where it is today. He told us, don't only talk to students, talk to lawyers and talk to academics. Take your ideas out of Washington, out into the heartland of America. So it's with those inspirational words that we've worked to make the Federalist Society a forum for the debate of intellectual ideas. And it's with warm hearts that we welcome him here tonight.
Thank you, David, very much. I appreciate those remarks. One correction. I didn't say I had to be in bed early, but I said as I was wanting to be out of here at 9:30. I know I'm a lot older than you are, but doesn't necessarily mean I'm going home to be in bed early. I just said I wanted to be out of here at 9:30, and I'm still going to do my best. I've got a busy day tomorrow. I'm head coach for the Yellow Ninjas soccer team, group of 7-year-olds. We're playing the White Knights tomorrow at Stoddart Field in Northwest at 11 o'clock. If the panels aren't everything they're supposed to be, just come on out. It's good ball. Kids try hard. It's a work ethic. We cut a lot of oranges up at halftime. We'll have some extras for you. What I wanted to do tonight is be a third person in the Epstein-Cutler debate, and you all remember where we are in that. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that. It's been a busy week, a long week for me, and I imagine for many of you and for anybody who's been watching the hearings, and I don't see any reason to go on at great length. David was kind enough to put me on first and said the formal business follows later. I knew you would not be pleased to hear that. So I'm going to run through this pretty quickly. It has been a week we will remember. I have had a belly full of the hearing. I don't know about you. Not a belly full of law, I suppose. More like a belly full of politics, or what I decided it was this afternoon, jurisprudence light. Law actually would have been okay in comparison to what we got, natural law a little bit. I think we can still say it in public. I hope we can. That to which we are entitled by the laws of nature and of nature's God, and that part's not funny. That's the serious part. And that's the part right before the part that everybody knows. But it sort of leads in from there. And it would be interesting to say, well, that's sort of what I mean by natural law. Is there a problem with the Declaration of Independence that the Senate would like to discuss here on television? I'm not a lawyer, so you all know a lot more about this than I do. But it seems to me if you were examining someone for the court, you want to look at their character, that person's character and that person's temperament, and it would seem to me for the court you would want to look at that person's competence, their familiarity with the law, how learned are they, how conversant are they with the cases that have been decided. Do they know the cases? Do they know the history? And it struck me that very, very few questions were along those lines. Very, very few questions were, could you describe to us what happened in Dred Scott, and then what happened in Plessy versus Ferguson, and then what happened in Brown versus Board, what was the changing position of the court here? Rather, most of the questions struck me as, are you politically correct or not? And that's a very different kind of question. Again, you're all much more expert in these matters than I am, but it seems to me it's not too much of a jump to say that if the Senate begins to decide about a candidate based on their approval of his view as a judge, then it seems to me they are starting to encroach and decide what should be decided by a co-equal branch of government. And that seems to me to be a problem. But I'll leave that for you tomorrow, and you can tell me at the soccer game whether I have that right. As for Justice Thomas, he's a friend, and I think he's going to be confirmed, and I think that's just terrific. I think he's a great guy. And I'm glad that he has not seen any obligation to place his head in the noose by talking about things which he should not talk about. The notion that people just want to have a general and abstract discussion of things without any reference to any particular decision would be belied the instant he gave any indication of where he stood on these general and abstract things, at which point they would say exactly where that would lead in terms of a decision. And he would be finished. So I'm glad he's not fallen into that trap. It seems to me that he has many opportunities left, and I hope he will take some of them. And one of the opportunities he has is to say, without saying necessarily that the views of his critics or interrogators are correct, that that he has seen the American system of justice from several perspectives. And one of them, to paraphrase Harvey Mansfield, is a perspective from the bottom up. He's seen the American system of justice from underneath, and that puts him in a very special and privileged position. He knows about these things from the bottom up, unlike many of the people who are asking him questions, who know about the bottom only from copies of letters they get faxed to them from pressure groups and their summer retreats. He really does know something about the things which are indeed mere abstractions to many of his critics, and that's worth saying. I think he'll be confirmed. I think he'll be a fine judge. I think we'll be proud of him. And yet, at the end of the week, if someone were to ask me my feeling, my one sentiment, I guess my one sentiment and feeling or dominant one would be how much I admire Bob Bork. Bob Bork had his version of Here I Stand, I Can Do No Other, And Yet It Moves, Galileo, or Johnny Paycheck's Take This Job. Bob Bork is very, very high in my estimation right now for standing up for what he said and believed. They're both very good men, and those are my thoughts at the end of the week. But I'm supposed to talk to you about individual responsibility, and I will do so very briefly. Individual responsibility in the law. I'll leave the law part to you for reasons that'll be clear as I go through my remarks. You'll see that I don't know too much about the law, and I will also confess, not something I regret all that much. I think it's worth talking about individual responsibility without talking about individual responsibility in the law, because I find individual responsibility, the individual responsibility part of the title, is like that other title that I know pretty well, the Federalist, often invoked but rarely talked about. The Federalist, often invoked but rarely read. And individual responsibility is something people nod to but don't really talk about very much when they talk about topics like this. Philosophers do, and that's a good thing, but we need to have, I think, more of a public conversation about the notion of individual responsibility, in which we do something more than just nod in its direction. Philosophers, of course, do all sorts of things which may or may not be interesting to the public. I remember when I went to the American Philosophical Association meetings in Philadelphia, because the theme that year was human rights, and I went to a six-hour session that began at 3 in the afternoon on the topic, are there any human rights? And the person who led off the session said, we'll spend the first 4 hours on the locution, are there any, and the last hour or so on human rights. And we all went to see Bonnie and Clyde that night, I remember, and got back in time for the rights part. In any case, individual responsibility is worth talking about. I'd like to say what I think it is, and I'd like to talk about it not from the books I read as a philosopher, but from some of my own experiences in individual responsibility. I've been thinking about that a lot lately and been writing some about it, and wonder how it is that we make the case for individual responsibility, particularly how we make the case to children about individual responsibility. And it might just be worth a couple of minutes to review how we go about doing that. I am no paragon of this particular virtue of individual responsibility. I think I'm pretty good as the world goes, not great in this town, not bad at all, but outside the Beltway, pretty average. But how did I learn it? I don't know. I think there are many influences. The earliest crash or shock or collision I had with the notion of individual responsibility came, and I think probably the first one, the second one, the third one, maybe the first 10 came because of my training in the Catholic Church. I went to Catholic school, and they stressed that a lot. That was a big, big deal, and still is, and that's a good thing. I remember distinctly coming home from school in Brooklyn, walking up Flatbush Avenue and going by Siegel's Delicatessen, where we often stopped after school to get a dill pickle or some French fries or maybe a hot dog. And I ordered a hot dog and realized it was Friday afternoon. And the way we were taught then, you're not supposed to eat meat on Friday, and these were all beef hot dogs, of course, at Siegel's. what to do, and I decided, I don't know why I decided it, but I decided, not knowing the phrase, I later heard the phrase, if you're going to sin, sin boldly. I somehow knew it in my bones or in my belly, this phrase. And when I realized it was Friday and the hot dog was coming, I said, give me three. And then I went to confession. And I was told this was wrong. And how sorry was I about this? Was I truly penitent? Penance was the word then, not reconciliation. Penance was the word. And I tried to think about how sorry I really was. And I wasn't hungry at the time I went to confession, so I wasn't that sorry. But there was an out, though, and it's a very important out for human beings that the Church has provided. It's called the distinction between perfect and imperfect contrition. Perfect contrition means you're sorry for what you've done because it has offended God, and you don't want to do that. He doesn't deserve that. Imperfect contrition is you're sorry because if you keep it up, you're going to burn in hell. And I mustered at least, mustard is not a joke here. I mustered at least imperfect contrition. That's all I could do and went on. But I remember being scolded for it. And I remember feeling that I wasn't sufficiently penitent. So I told my mother about it, and she said that I was overreaching. I'm sure that wasn't the word she used. Overeating and overreaching, and it was an experience I won't forget. Lots of experiences like that with the Church, with lots of people telling me and my classmates that what we were doing were wrong or was wrong. Now, some of the time, I think the experiences and situations and incidents they used. Maybe they weren't all that accurate. And certainly, I think there was a problem of distinguishing between relatively unimportant and relatively much more important things. But nevertheless, those were the rules, that was the code. And there were people there saying that some things were right and other things were wrong. A second experience when I was in the Boy Scouts, in New York, which is an odd experience in itself. not odd in the current way the Boy Scouts experience may be odd, but in Brooklyn, being a Boy Scout is tough because merit badges are not geared. They're sort of discrimination against kids in big cities for merit badges. A lot of these things have to do with not with things that are available and readily available in Brooklyn, but subways. There's no merit badge for subways or for hitting the interchange at Grand Central or something and identifying IRT, IND. But we had a camping trip, which gave us all an opportunity to get several merit badges you otherwise couldn't get. A camping trip in Brooklyn means you take the subway to the Dixie Terminal, and then you take a bus up to the Catskills, and you cross this six-lane highway and go up a hill and camp. Pretty sad, but we did it. We did it, and we were armed and ready for nature, red in tooth and claw. And we got up there, and we were supposed to start our fires and do all this, but we didn't do it. Several of us snuck down the back of the hill to Carvel's on the highway and had dinner. You notice a lot of my experiences here have to do with eating. And this is the nature of man. We're all flawed. We're flawed in different ways. This is the way I'm flawed. Anyway, the scoutmaster was furious and said that we were not being good scouts because we weren't doing what we were supposed to do. Told us we were wrong, and he was right. We sort of frustrated, missed the point of the whole trip. When I was at high school here in Gonzaga High School in Washington, D.C., very good high school, we used to practice on the Ellipse. And when we played football, we had our football team go down to the Ellipse. We had an old bus, and we drove down to the Ellipse. This was before they built the new field called Buchanan Field after a distinguished, truly distinguished graduate of Gonzaga, Buchanan's, many Buchanan's. And I remember the humiliation that I was put through by my coach, who thought that I wasn't working hard enough. Coaches rarely do think you're working hard enough, and would make you run laps and do push-ups where the tourists were around the Ellipse going to the Washington Monument. Again, pretty tough stuff, but the lesson from my coach was clear enough that I wasn't doing my job. I wasn't doing what I had signed on to do, and I remember him telling me pretty distinctly and pretty clearly as the scoutmaster, as the church, as my parents, that what I was doing was wrong. Williams College, I'll go through this very quickly. My junior year, one of my fraternity brothers got so drunk he couldn't move in the morning. He was on disciplinary probation at Williams, which meant if you cut a class when you were on disciplinary probation, you would be thrown out of the school. So we carried him to class. And it was a seminar, Professor Orville. Some of you may experience this tomorrow or some likeness of this, but we carried Dick to class, to the seminar, and sat him there. And the professor marked him absent. And that's when one of my teachers identified me as having an instinct for law school, because I said, no, he's present. How can you say he's absent? That sort of cleverness that makes people say you should go to law school. anyway, the dean at Williams called us in and said, bad stunt, bad behavior. You guys shouldn't be doing this anyway. You guys shouldn't be wrecking your college careers like this. And it was very cute, and it was a nice act of self-defense or defense of a friend and a classmate, but it doesn't work. And what you did was wrong. Those are all, I know, pretty severe examples and pretty serious examples, but this message was sort of coming across over a period of time for me. I should end with a law school experience. I was at Harvard, because I promised I'd explain to you why I don't know much about the law, and after my first year at law school, maybe I already have explained to you. All right. After my first year, I took my course list into my advisor for my second year courses. And my advisor was a tax professor named Andrews. I think it was Andrews. Andrews wore a bow tie. Does anybody remember? Is that Andrews? Okay. All tax professors wear bow ties. Thank you. And my courses were legal history, jurisprudence, two jurisprudence courses, comparative law, Russian law, and law and ethics. And he said, what is this? And I said, it's a program of study at the Harvard Law School for second year students. And he said, you can't be anything with this kind of a program. And I said, I don't want to be anything. I'm working on my PhD in philosophy, and I'm interested in jurisprudence. I want to study this. And he said, I don't think I can sign this. I mean, there's nothing on this list. There's no corporations. There's no, what do you take, second year tax. There's no commercial transactions. There's no deconstructive. No, he didn't say that. I'm making that up. Anyway, he said, go back and think about this, which was a very nice thing for him to do, because I really did have to go back and think about it and realize that I was at supposedly one of the great law schools in America, blowing my chances to be a lawyer in the way that many people there were going to be lawyers. And I had to think about what I wanted to be when I grew up and whether I really wanted to take this course of study. And I decided, yeah, I did. And I went back to see him, and he said, I think it's wrong. There was that word again. And I said, I'm going to do it anyway. Now, at that point, those of you who are jurisprudes, I said jurisprudes. I don't want anybody to misunderstand what I said. understand that I shifted from talking about the morality of obligation to the morality of aspiration. I started to talk and think, at least in this context, about not just what I was obligated to do as a member of society, or as a Catholic, or as a Boy Scout, or as an undergraduate, as a student, but what I wanted to do and be when I was grown up, in terms of my goals, in terms of my aims. But still, there was someone there in my life giving me some guidance and judgment about it. The reason I bring all this up is not to be tedious, I hope, and not to go on too long, but to say that it seemed to me, however it turns out, it was extremely helpful for me along the way to have had a lot of people lined up at various stations of my life saying certain things to me about my behavior, about my actions, about the steps I was taking. People who were even honest enough and candid enough to say, what you did here was wrong. You violated the rules. This isn't right. Get back on track. Robert Coles, in his study of the Girl Scouts, a study that he did with several other people, points out that one of the biggest problems with kids these days is that nobody is giving them any guidance whatsoever. Nobody is telling them this is right or this is wrong. There's a lot of congratulatory stuff going on, but there's not a lot of straight speaking about things. I know the difficulties of laying it on too heavy and laying it on too thick and coming on with too tough a view of the world. Nevertheless, I think, and it was interesting to read this review in this book by Coles, that he thinks we need more such stating of a candid statement of responsibility on the part of adults, not less. In one section of the book, and I leave this to you to think about, Cole says that one thing he's very worried about is the use in the schools of what's called self-esteem and the emphasis on self-esteem. He worries that too much emphasis on self-esteem might lead students not to have an appropriate degree of guilt or regret about actions they have taken. I would hope that we could strike a path which is neither dumbly or naively caricatured in this self-esteem kind of prototype, at the same time one that isn't makes the child so guilt-ridden that the child is no longer able to function. When you look around at things like facts in the world and see the condition of many of our young people, I think it is fair to say that the problem, the shortage right now, and this suggests to us where we ought to shift our weight, is toward saying those things again, saying them with love, saying them with understanding, saying them with patience, but saying them again. If we just nod in the direction of individual responsibility, but do not teach it, do not take the trouble of taking a stand for it, daily in schools and in playgrounds and in soccer games and in other places, it seems to me then we cannot complain that things are going badly, but nobody seems to be doing anything about it. If there are false bids for government securities or lousy investments on the part of savings and loans, or people deciding to spend their time knocking out crack, or people fathering children but not fathering to them, perhaps where our attention and energies have to go is in standing at these various stations, saying these things along the way. Again, saying them with patience, saying them with tolerance and understanding, but nevertheless saying them, as Learned Hand said, or to paraphrase Learned Hand, so that we do not have a society so riven that the courts and the laws cannot save. It seems to me that, as Holmes said, the solution to most of our problems is for us to grow more civilized. And the way we grow more civilized is by remembering those steps we have to take along the way. if we don't take the steps and stand at the stations, it's possible that no one will. Thank you very much. Thanks for your attention.